Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett's the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films are Parasite, Aquarella, and The Lighthouse, which goes very well with Aquarella, if I do say so myself.
I suppose it does. Maybe that is why I put those two things together, Aquarella and The Lighthouse. But let us begin with Parasite, not the most appealing title of the year, but I guess it's an intriguing title. Certainly made me interested when I first heard it. This is a film from South Korea. It is by Bong Joon-ho, who is pretty much without question the leading South Korean filmmaker of our day. And South Korea has a very major film industry, and they produce a good deal of artful cinema as well as commercial cinema. And Parasite actually won the biggest prize, the Golden Palm, the Palme d'Or, at the Cannes Film Festival this past spring, and now it is playing in American theaters. And it turns out to be a very unusual movie in all kinds of ways. Now, Bong Joon-ho makes unusual movies. His last movie, Okja, was a sort of environmental thriller about a comedy thriller about a sort of a very, very strange, one-of-a-kind beast. Snowpiercer, which I think is one of the best science fiction movies of recent years, took place on a train. And anyway, makes unusual movies. And right now we have Parasite, which is sort of about what it says. It's not a horror movie. It's sort of a fantasy, and it's kind of one of a kind. So Parasite begins with what is obviously a very down-on-its-luck family. We have parents and young adult kids who are they're all sort of scrambling around this crummy little place, this sort of basement apartment where they live, very upset because one of their neighbors has suddenly put a password onto that person's Wi-Fi, and now they can't sort of leech off this person's Wi-Fi all the time. And what are they going to do? And they're scrambling all over the apartment looking somewhere for some other signal that they can hook onto. And we immediately, in the very first seconds of this movie, start to think, well, in a way, these people are sort of like parasites in a sort of a way. And we then discover that that's kind of what they do. They live in miserable circumstances. They don't have any money. They don't seem bothered by this. They mainly are just always trying to think of ways in which they can sort of get something for nothing. So something then happens. One of the young adults in the family gets an opportunity to become the English tutor to a very wealthy young woman who lives with her very privileged parents and her little brother in a really, really nice house. And this young man is not really an English tutor at all, but he can get away. He knows enough English to get away with pretending to be one. So he goes off and he takes this position as English tutor to this young girl, charms her parents. He then manages one by one to start getting his other members of his family jobs in this household. He manages to get his sister a job in the household. He manages to get his, and not just him, but then the family members start helping each other so that they manage through a very sneaky trick to get the family chauffeur fired, and then the fathers gets the chauffeur job. Then through another really sneaky trick, they get the very longtime housekeeper fired, and then the mother comes in and becomes the housekeeper for the family, and they're all leeching off of this wealthy family by getting these jobs under false pretenses, and kind of in mean-spirited ways too, by getting existing people in these jobs in the household fired. Then, long into the movie, we discover that there's a whole other level of parasitism going on within this household. And I won't tell you what that is. And that is really what the movie is about. So the way I'm describing it probably makes it sound sort of goofy and implausible. It is goofy and implausible. But hey, it's a movie. And Bong Joon-ho, the director, the writer-director, really gets us, the co-writer-director, really gets us believing it every step of the way. It becomes more outrageous as it goes along. The little boy in the rich family becomes quite an important character in various ways. And you can sort of never tell where the story's going to go yet. I found Parasite mostly a really, really good movie. Again, sometimes it just gets so goofy that I wasn't really quite sure I believed it. It's a little bit longer than it needs to be. It's well over 2 hours. But the acting is really good. And again, the story is just so kind of zany, and the characters are so kind of zany that, it really engaged me pretty much from beginning to end. Now, there are people who are seeing it all as a great kind of a social commentary on capitalism and on the way that people exploit each other, and it is those things. But if you just want to take it as a movie, which basically I did, to just have a good time with for 2 hours plus, you'll have a good time with it. Bong Joon-ho is an amazingly creative filmmaker, has all kinds of wacky ideas, and my gosh, the parts of this family that take place in this wealthy household are just so nice looking. It's a nice looking place, and it has lovely grounds, and I just found the whole thing quite watchable. So Parasite, I'm not really sure it deserved the highest prize at the Cannes Film Festival, which is probably the world's most influential and important film festival. I'm not quite sure it's that good a movie, but it's a real good movie. And if you just want to have some good time, and especially if you're into Asian cinema at all, go see Parasite. You'll have a nice time. Second film today, Aquarella, is a really, really different in all kinds of ways. First of all, it's a documentary, but it's an unconventional documentary. It is not about giving us information because it really doesn't do much of that, but it's about giving us a real visual and audiovisual spectacle entirely from the real world because it's all totally real material, and it is absolutely spectacular in all kinds of ways. It was made by a Russian filmmaker named Viktor Kosakovsky. And although the film itself is an international co-production, and it was filmed, the movie never tells you exactly where we are, but we know where we are in very cold places because this movie is about water and about ice. A lot of it was filmed in Greenland. And what they did was they took a crew, Kosakovsky took a crew, and they went around to what they were planning to shoot was glaciers, giant glaciers that were ready to fall apart. And this movie can be taken all as a great extended commentary on climate change. That's what they went off to shoot. They were going to shoot glaciers that were ready to simply crumble, slide apart, fall apart because of the raising temperatures and the ice melting. But they ran across all kinds of different things. The beginning of the movie, which I found very effectively mysterious, there are these people way out in the middle of this ice, and there's nothing around but ice and snow and underneath, they're looking at something underneath the ice, and gradually we realize what they're looking at. It's a car. A car has fallen into the water. The ice has frozen over it, and now these people are trying to determine how they're going to get the car out of the water, or I should say out of the water under the ice. And that's the sort of thing that happens in the movie. At another point in the movie, we see a car speeding along the ice in the distance. You can drive on this ice. It's real solid. It's really not very risky. And then all of a sudden, the car just falls right through the ice. And the filmmakers witness this, and they film this. Now, most of the movie is not dramatic human stuff like this. Most of the movie really is shots of water and of ice. The ice is often melting. The ice is often moving. The water is turning into ice. The ice is turning back into water. And that's what the movie is. Now, all of this was shot with exceedingly high-tech digital cameras that were shooting 96 frames per second. Now, at almost every movie theater where this is being shown, it's going to be shown at a more normal rate. Some places, 48 frames a second. Some places, the normal for American movies, 24 frames a second, I should say, for American movie theaters. So you're not going to see this phenomenal 96 frames per second rate that the material was shot at, but still shooting it at that rate gets all kinds of detail. And this movie is very, very dramatic in its detail. It is nature imagery of the most sort of ferocious sort. There's no narration. We never really know exactly where we are. We never really know exactly what is happening. What we just have is a lot of music and a certain amount of sound effects while we watch all of this going on. So again, it's an unconventional documentary because, as I said before, it's not meant to give us information. You don't come out of the movie having learned about conditions in Greenland or something like that. What you've really done is been able to witness them. So in a way, it's kind of like being a tourist, kind of wandering away from the guide for a while. And that's the way the movie is designed, and that's the way the movie is structured. We can certainly draw conclusions from this movie about the kind of effects that the climate change may be having on some fragile parts of the icebound world. But mainly, Aquarella is an audiovisual spectacle. In other words, it is pure cinema, and pure cinema taken entirely from reality. That makes it an unusual movie. I found it after a while. I had had enough. And it doesn't really need to go on for quite as long as it does. I said the same thing about Parasite. In this case, we have a movie which is only about an hour and a half long. But again, because it isn't giving us information about what we're seeing, after a while you sort of start to say, well, I've sort of seen this stuff now. I'm not sure I need a whole lot more. But again, it is a truly spectacular movie. And if you're interested in issues of climate change, certainly it is a must-see. And if you're just interested in spectacular audiovisual experience, it's a movie that you'll have a good time at. Our final movie today, The Lighthouse, also, as you might guess from the title, involves water. But now we have a movie which is basically, it's a thriller, it's a horror movie, it turns into a kind of a fantasy. It's a very unusual movie made by Robert Eggers, who directed it and co-wrote it. His previous movie was a film called The Witch, a very, very effective horror movie about the world of witchcraft. The Lighthouse, it's also basically a horror movie, but it's very, very minimalist, very pared-down movie, and on that level alone, it is quite an amazing achievement. So what we have is, it is ultimately turns out to be sort of a three-character drama, but basically it is really a two-character drama, because I would say for about 99.5% of the running time, we are seeing two characters played by the great Willem Dafoe and the very interesting Robert Pattinson. And they play a couple of lighthouse keepers. And Willem Dafoe plays the older one. He's been around for a long time. He's got a game leg. He can no longer travel the sea like he used to on great ships. Now all he can really do because of his leg is to work in a lighthouse. But he is the senior member of the team. And Robert Pattinson plays the junior member of the team, who himself has been around a while. He's no kid. And he's fairly wizened and seasoned and craggy himself. But he's definitely the younger member and the junior member of the team. And his job is to follow the orders of the senior member of the team. And their job together is to take care of the lighthouse. And their names, maybe I should say, for convenience sake. The older one is Thomas and the younger one is Ephraim. And Thomas regards it as his great duty to look after the light itself, while Ephraim has to do all of the other jobs around the place. Keep the place clean. Keep the place neat. And it turns out that the older one, Thomas, is a real kind of he's kind of a tyrant. He is always trying to get Ephraim to loosen up and have a drink, but at the same time, he's always bossing Ephraim around and making Ephraim do all the dirty jobs and so forth and so on. So this goes on for a while, and you can sort of expect to see where the movie is going. And in fact, it does go there. At least it's where I expected. These two get on each other's nerves. They are alone in this little lighthouse and adjoining house, and that is all there is, and all they're doing, especially Ephraim, is working really, really, really hard all the time, and Thomas is very busy being a tyrant all the time. So they get on each other's nerves, and it gets even worse than that. And then, and this is kind of what I expected to happen, they start to go sort of crazy. Alcohol plays a part in this. Also, Ephraim's not being used to this sort of life plays a part in this, but they start going crazy, and the clashes between them. I don't want to say they get more violent, although they ultimately do, but they just get more sort of insane. And the movie develops a sort of accumulated claustrophobic power as these two, you really can't tell where their emotions are going to go next. And they never know where their emotions are going to go next. All you know is that there's really no escape from the situation for them or for the audience. Yes, at one point, after a very reasonable period of time, they're supposed to get picked up by a boat that's going to take them away, and their stint will be over, and they'll get a break from all this. But then there's a storm, and the boat doesn't come, or maybe the boat does come, and they just didn't see the boat. But in any case, they are now stuck on the lighthouse and in the little adjoining house for even longer. Now, one of the really interesting choices that Robert Eggers has made in filming this movie is to film it in a very narrow aspect ratio, which is to say that the screen is not the wide screen which we're used to nowadays. It's closer to the old square screen that movies used to have before about the 1950s or even into the 1950s. And this, of course, gives us this the shape of the screen to a certain extent echoes the shape of the lighthouse and the configuration of this little narrow house that these two are stuck in. So the film itself, for the audience, for us watching it, has this claustrophobia, which echoes what the men are feeling within the movie itself. Ultimately, by the way, the movie develops almost a sort of a mythic power. After a while, I got tired of the story. I thought, I really don't need these two guys just going crazy with each other on and on and on and on. So, okay, enough is enough. But then all of a sudden, there would be some astounding image, often with a mythological sort of cast to it that would just draw me right back into the movie. And I would say, well, the story may not be going a whole lot of places, but the imagery, the way the film looks, is really quite amazing, at least from time to time. So if you're interested in horror stories, if you're interested in toxic masculinity of a sort of exotic sort, then The Lighthouse is for you. It's not one of the great horror movies of recent times, but it's pretty horrific, and I found it pretty engaging just as a sort of a human drama of two people going nuts with each other and bringing the audience part of the way there too. So that is my somewhat lunatic story this week, Jill.
Perfect timing, David Sterrett. Films in focus, the films Parasite, Aquarella, and The Lighthouse.